Okay, so I don't know if our listeners know this, but Andy actually doesn't let me out of the basement between seasons.
I mean, you get to do the chickens, but yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, but they have sunlight and I don't, which, I don't know, that seems rough. I haven't talked to anyone in months.
I mean, you look good. No skin damage from the sun's UV rays, so you got that going for you. And now you get to talk about pawpaws.
You know what? That's true. I'm going to look back on this when I'm 70 with my baby smooth skin and be like, he was right.
Just a creepy old man with like no wrinkles. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Smiling moon face.
Yeah. You're going to have smiling moon face. You're going to be paw-pilled. We're getting paw-pilled with the big papa.
Yeah. You know what? The basement was better than this.
Yeah, you say that, but
take me back.
There are dozens of people listening. Mm-hmm. Welcome back. Season 5. At least one of us hasn't quit after 5 seasons. We don't we're 100% here 50% of the time or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys are here for some reason still listening, so we're coming back at you with that thick, juicy content.
And if you want to protest it, don't listen to it.
Yeah, just fucking don't. I don't care.
Anyway.
Anyways. So pawpaws, let's get into it. Unlike most of the fruits that we're talking about this season, there's a lot of research about pawpaws. Pawpaw, Astilba, Triloba, which my Latin's terrible, so don't judge me. It's known as the poor man's banana, the Indiana banana, which sounds like some weird sex move. Like, we're doing the Indiana banana tonight. Yeah, I don't
know. Give them the old Indiana banana.
The custard apple. Yeah, it just keeps going on. We don't need to know them all. Not that important. Now, for folks unfamiliar, wild pawpaws are like these kidney-shaped or kind of kidney-shaped fruits. They're like usually between like 2 and 6 inches long, and they grow in these little clusters. Now, not only is it like one of the lesser known fruits in North America, it's also the largest, and the big ones are largest by like a very large margin. Now, in the wild, they're often found like alongside rivers. They really like deep soils for their deep tap roots, and you tend to see them in like bottomlands of like, you know, hills near rivers and things like that. And they're like an understory tree. So unlike like the nut series, where almost 75% of the trees we talked about were like canopy trees and old growth forest trees, the pawpaw, you typically find it under like oaks and hickories and tulip poplars and black walnuts. And it makes sense given when we covered like black walnuts, the kind of, and hickories even, what kind of ecosystems they tended to live within. While it can cross-pollinate, that's not typically how it procreates or propagates in the wild. It typically grows in like these patches from suckering. So you'll see like a giant like patch of pawpaws, and chances are they're almost all related. And those pawpaw patches end up producing almost no fruit.
Okay, so if that's why I see like a big patch of pawpaws, it can have tons of fruit or no fruit. It's like whether or not there's another plant nearby that pollinates the whole patch.
Exactly. The fruiting process for the pawpaw is unique. They're not pollinated by bees, but actually by carrion flies and beetles.
Gross.
Those nasty little bugs. They love pawpaws because pawpaws have these like very dark red and smelly flowers. And the belief is that they evolved to basically smell like rotting meat.
Okay, so not only do they sucker to become a thicket, but then that thicket smells like roadkill.
Yeah, that's it. You got it. Doesn't it sound delicious?
Yep.
While the smell isn't overpowering if you've got a couple trees in your backyard, it is enough to draw like the pollinators in, and that's what's important, right? Now we've got to do my favorite thing, and we've got to go back in time.
Oh boy, we got to start this season strong. We're going back, what? A few thousand years, a couple of ice ages, or just the one?
A millennia or two, yes. The reason why the pawpaw is really worth exploring as our first and weirdest fruit in like temperate North America is that they really seem like out of place, right? They're this fruit that is like sweet and tropically and not related really to anything else around us. And they're just like this really cool, weird thing. And they're actually the only members of the Anacinaceae in North America. And now how they ended up here is still up for debate. The most likely theory is that a group of these trees in the Rio Grande region likely included an ancient ancestor. And for whatever reason, most likely in the last two ice ages, this was the only survivor to handle the harsh climate. During the last ice age, one part of Trilobo was pushed to south of Mexico, or south to Mexico, and another was pushed east to present-day Florida.
Okay, so this was a bifurcating the population, two subpopulations.
Fancy. Yes, I like it. And that's going to be important because if you guys remember the oak tree episode, it created some really unique and exciting things for the acorn as we know it, which I might be like one of four people that have ever said a sentence with those string of words ever.
Yeah, I'll call up Guinness.
Let them know.
I'll see what they have to say.
Do you think I could get on one of those Google plaques that like when somebody Googles a sentence for the first time?
They get a plaque?
Yeah, if you've Googled something that no one else has ever Googled before, they send you a plaque. Did you not know this?
No.
It's not like a fancy plaque, but it's still like this like little thing that has the sentence you search.
That'd be really troubling, I think.
I want to know that I'm the first person on the entire earth to Google this. Anyways, totally unrelated. So there are actually seven other Asimina species, six of which are only found in Florida and southern Georgia. And then there's the seventh, which is what's called the dwarf pawpaw, which extends as far as Virginia. Tiny little plant, hence the name dwarf, given that pawpaws aren't big in the first place. The common pawpaw, the one that everyone's thinking of, the one that we're talking about primarily, that covers the most ground by like a very wide margin. The others are kind of just these little like ecotypes almost. While the family that the pawpaw belongs to contains over 2,000 species, it is only the Asimina that can handle any frost at all. And what's wild is that the pawpaw itself can actually handle temperatures as low as 20 degrees negative Fahrenheit.
Okay, so it's like the genetic anomaly.
By like a very wide margin. Like to be able to go 50 degrees below freezing when no one else can go to freezing is like massive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Besides being like a delicious fruit, the pawpaw is also important because it's the only host plant for the zebra swallowtail butterfly, and it's used primarily as like a feed for during its caterpillar stage. The biggest challenge today for the pawpaw is actually the fragmented ecosystem because of suburbanization, industrialization, and of course, invasive species pressure.
Okay, so is it on the list? Is it at risk?
It's not on any lists, but it's more of an anecdotal thing at this point where a lot of older folks in regions where it once existed as like just a very common tree will just say like, oh, we don't see it anymore. I haven't seen one since I was a kid. Things like that where part of it's probably less management, part of it's probably suburbanization, but part of it is probably that it is losing landscape and habitat, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's unique about pawpaw is that it's not a very preferred species by native herbivores, but when invasives move in, pawpaws do become one of the most preferred species over, like, it's like, okay, you've eaten everything else. If the pawpaw is the one that's left, they'll go after that before a lot of invasive species. So if there's a site that's already disturbed from invasive pressure, pawpaw is the one that's going to get hit the hardest. And my guess is it also has the least tools for protection because it's not very appealing to bugs and things like that.
Mm. So it's the least preferred food and it's getting eaten. Not a good sign when our bugs seem to be starving.
No, I mean, I don't think anything could be bad about that. So, yeah, let's take a quick break and we're going to jump into a bit more recent piece of the fruit's history.
Hey there, it's me, Crazy Norm, down at Normal Norm's Nut Emporium on John Brown Drive. We're going nuts for nuts in Nutty November. We've got big nuts, small nuts, chestnuts, ground nuts, nut butter, buttery nuts, nut milk, milky nuts, nut cream, creamy nuts, and for the late night crowd, chocolate-covered CBD, deep-fried nuts. Want to join the nut extravaganza? Nut up and join the nut posse. Join other members and get your sack of nuts pounded for free whenever you come in and make the creamiest nut milk you've ever had in your own kitchen. Crazy Norm's Nut Emporium, 420 John Brown Drive or online at fortproles.com.
Andy, you can't call them that.
What?
Oh, never mind.
Oh, the gays. Making gay jokes, Matt. Okay, so when colonists arrived in North America, pawpaws were of significant interest. In William Bertram's Bertram's Travels, he discusses the pawpaw extensively. Also, in Jesuit Relations of 1656-1657, the book that's actually sitting right next to Matt's bed at the moment.
Mm-hmm. That one.
That one. Just some light reading. They write that, and this is a quote, "There are apples as large as a goose's egg. The seed has been brought from the country of the cats and looks like beans. The fruit is delicate and has a very sweet smell. The trunk is of the height and thickness of our dwarf trees. It thrives in swampy spots and in good soil." End quote. So that's a sweet, sweet paragraph. I don't know what the country of cats is, but I love it.
I was going to ask. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Country of cats.
Yeah. Catstown.
Well, there is the Isle of Dogs.
You know, maybe they were just like the place where all the some fucking feral cats took over.
Yeah.
So yeah, while today we think of the pawpaw as being like the southern fruit or even like a Midwestern and southern fruit, that's not necessarily the case. And like these writers kind of point to that, as we're going to see in a minute, that there's even documentation of pawpaw in like New York when the colonists arrive.
I mean, given how we've seen other species travel north, that's not like totally surprising, is it? I mean, we talked about how the Five Nations had managed to get the Ozark chinkapins on their landscape. So is pawpaws like a big stretch for that?
Yeah, I mean, the real question is how the pawpaw reached its northern distribution, especially like further north, such as like the Great Lakes region. Some researchers have said that like the Iroquois populations were responsible for pushing the trees that far north, in some cases like as far as Ontario.
Whoa.
Yeah, so pretty far north, like for something again that here in New England isn't a common tree, but it actually lived in even cooler climates, right? Now, some researchers like James Murphy argue that trees moved through dispersal by non-human animals. And then there's this guy, we're going to talk more about him, and he may or may not be on the podcast next week.
Ooh.
A guy named Neil Peterson suggests that it's probably both.
Okay, so it was either like people or raccoons,
the pawpaw's almanac.
I was...
yeah, I know, it's wild. Either people, animals, or both. Like, strangely, no one suggested aliens. But there's still time. Matt, that could be you.
Now that's interesting. It was just the pawpaw though. They were like, they're pretty just interested in that one, that and mangoes.
They only come to Earth for the pawpaws.
Mm-hmm. It's like, this place sucks. Like, we're going to get out of here quick.
That's fair. I also would join them if I had the opportunity. Aliens, come take me if you're listening.
Outer space pawpaw. Traitors.
So the argument that it was driven entirely by humans were these two researchers, Keener and Kuhn. And their argument was basically based in Matt's favorite book, Jesuit Relations. And in the book, it talks about this idea that the indigenous people that they were meeting talked about how the pawpaw were associated with the war going on of 1654 and 1655. And that if the fruit had existed before, then they wouldn't have like this really strong connection to this very recent event, right? It was like, oh, why would they be called, like, why would pawpaw be associated if it had been there for 200 years? That's basically the framework of like this idea that only by humans and only fairly recently were they moved this far north. Even like out west, it was very common to still see human management of pawpaw because they would always be planted on like hunting trails, specifically in regions like Kansas.
I mean, that does kind of make sense. And we talked about some other crops that have been, like, their management was purposely with trails before, right?
Yeah.
I mean, unless they had like an absolute bumper crop that year, right when the war changed or something.
Yeah, right. To the west, there's older evidence of the trees. A guy named Luis de Moscoso de Alvarado. That was terrible. Sorry. Luis de Mos. Whatever. Fuck it. That guy.
Louis M.
Louis M. Big Lou. He describes a pawpaw tree in Illinois County in the 1680s, describing it as, and this is a quote, "There are other trees as thick as one's leg, which bend under a yellowish fruit of the shape and size of a medium-sized cucumber, which the savages call a seminar. The French have given it an impertinent name. There are people who would not like it, but I find it very good. They have five or six nuclei inside, which are as big as marsh beans and about the same shape. I ate one day 60 of them, big and little. The fruit does not ripen until October like the medlars." Now, obviously ignoring his like very shitty language, it is worth noting though, they did use the Algonquin word from which the species name is derived today, right? The Azamina. The suffix "min" occurs in Algonquin languages and words when referring to the fruit or nut, such as in the words for like blueberries, maize, and more. The Algonquin language was spoken into the region of modern New York, suggesting that the tree had a history in this region, possibly prior to even reaching the Midwest, where we know it was managed by humans.
Oh, so the plot thickens. But I also kind of wonder what the rude name the French gave it.
Le Fros. Just some like guttural nasally sounds.
Oh, one of those fucking French, I swear to
Those
God.
fucking French, Jesus Christ. I should say that this doesn't necessarily mean the trees were brought this far north purposefully. Like they could have shown up there and then they were managed, right? We have fossils resembling the pawpaw in New Jersey as far back as the late Miocene.
Don't matter.
Don't matter. And that's like millions of years before humans even walked across North America. So I get a bit on the landscape between ice ages repeatedly. Fossils were found in the Don Valley of Toronto's excavation of a Pleistocene interglacial bed as well. The pawpaw species itself dates back 34 million years in the fossil record. So like I said, it's been around. The fruit were eaten by like ground sloths and woolly mammoths and mastodons. And that's why they have those giant ass seeds, because they could ingest like large quantities of these fruit and shit the seeds everywhere.
Walking trail math, baby.
Right?
I'm doing it.
Yeah, and like we are talking about a lot of these ancient fruits this season because they are really interesting and they have this like cool history of like management before humans. And then in some cases, not so much the pawpaw, but other species we'll talk about, where humans really kind of like picked up the torch when those megafauna disappeared. And it's just like a really cool like interspecies like management. But to get back to this like question of like who managed these, it was likely both, right? That megafauna spread the seeds, humans realized the fruit were good, and they also were like, cool, let's help grow more of these because they're delicious. Peterson, Neil Peterson, the guy we're going to be talking about a little bit more in a few minutes, suggests that humans saved some specific relict pawpaw stands from decline, and that's because of its aggressive homogenous shoots and from like inbreeding through seed spreading. So while, like, as we talked about, the pawpaw doesn't do a great job of like having a lot of biological diversity because of how it grows, right? Creates these like clusters that don't fruit necessarily because they're all the same genetics. So some it does need some like forced management, and humans likely had a very important role in that. While we do typically assign the value of pawpaw to its fruits, the tree actually has a lot of other uses. The fiber, it's considered like a fiber and a medicine plant. The bark was used, specifically the inner bark, for fishing nets by the Tuscarora. And Peterson also argues that stands were only kept, otherwise they'd get cut down for all these other uses, only if the fruit was good, which meant that there was a lot of selection pressure on fruit improvement over time, which passively probably improved the quality of fruit.
I mean, and like again, we've talked about this. This is how like most species were managed by indigenous people. So it would sort of make sense that some selection pressure was being applied.
Yeah, especially given that it's sat in a region where they're already selecting so many different plants, like we've talked about black walnuts and chestnuts and chinkapins. In the case of like black walnuts, literally in the same forest, right? Directly overhead the pawpaws. So like it would make sense that they're just going to do both, right? The fact that pawpaws grow in like the juglone filled soils of like black walnuts is really cool because it's like you get your fruit and nut crop right in the same spot. So you get that like black walnut pawpaw nut.
Jesus, Andy.
Listen, you knew what you're signing up for here.
Did I?
It's on you, Matt. You could have ran many years ago.
True.
Since the fruit stores poorly, it's always been treated, at least in modern times, in colonist times, I guess we could say, kind of as like the seasonal surplus, right? That we eat a bunch of it or a few fruit, and then it's like, oh, that was good, but I'm kind of worn out of it. I'm done with it. Whatever, I'll have some more next year. Well, evidence of seeds actually points to that, yes, there were seasonal feasts, like what we just talked about, but most indigenous tribes where the pawpaw existed would create dried cakes of the fruit pulp, some cooked and some raw.
Man, that sounds good.
Some cooked fruit pulp? Yes.
Yeah, pawpaw cake, yeah.
The paw cake?
A cake. Yeah.
I love it when you bake me big pawpaws.
Keep working on it.
Okay. So these dried cakes and these fruit pulps would be used in things like stews and sauces, be made into corn cakes, which would help like balance out the corn-heavy diets that they otherwise were eating. Sometimes people used ash to nixtamalize the pawpaws. Or they would use lye to do the same thing, which is very similar to like how we'd seen like acorns being managed and corn obviously being managed. I'd mentioned that the trees were used, not just the fruit. The Cherokee would make rope and string from the inner bark. And even further south, where they likely were managing the pawpaws longer, colonists that showed up would describe like pawpaw orchards being grown. So like they were very specifically and systematically being managed in a way that we don't typically think of when we're talking about pawpaw.
That's wild. And nixtamalizing pawpaws?
Yeah, I mean, they, especially like in the Northeast, they just fucking nixtamalized everything. I think what they probably were doing was trying to make like underripe fruit palatable. It probably had something to do with like fruit storage too, but we don't really seem to have any documentation. In terms of like the nixtamalization that I'm mentioning, it's basically a footnote of a personal correspondence from a book that I read. It's not like the most thoroughly vetted research, but for some reason, people believe that this was the case. And given that you can nixtamalize like persimmons, it would make sense.
Man, you're just dropping that kind of knowledge with no context, no reference.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can only go so deep in the research. Sometimes you're going to just go too deep. And I didn't want to call this guy on the phone being like, listen, hey, buddy, I saw in 1997 in a phone conversation, you were talking about nixtamalizing fruit, pawpaw fruit. I need the deets.
Tell me. Jesus.
Not there yet. Yeah.
Not quite.
Not yet. Give me a couple more seasons. Like if I ever lived off of podcast money,
God help
I would
us.
Be that guy. Yeah. Watch out. We're all doomed. So to get back on track, the strongest evidence of any like human managed dispersal of like the fruit and like its reach across the landscape comes from the genetic markers that we can see like certain things like specific rare alleles in wild populations at significantly greater distances when they're around an indigenous community than in the wild populations alone. So like if an allele typically only has a reach of 500 miles, for example, the ones around an indigenous like community would actually maybe be 600 or 700 miles, meaning that somebody probably ate the fruit and were like, these are really fucking good, took the seeds back or sold the seeds or traded the seeds or whatever might have been. So like these specific rare genetics have actually been documented to travel significantly further than the ones that aren't as good. Or at least that whatever was planted around indigenous communities weren't just like pulled from the local forests or whatever. They were specifically chosen to be around those communities. And I gave like that 500 miles as like a random number, but actually that is about the distance that people were able to document these rare genetics being traveled. So like somebody would find a seed in South Carolina and it would end up in Indiana or something like that. But that's a bad example, and we're going to talk about why in a minute. Sorry, too many sidetracks.
That's wild, and it makes sense. I mean, especially if you're like, you know, you have some friends or family or a trader visiting, like, yeah, check out the shit we got going on. Tell other people, take some fruit and tell other people how we grow these massive pawpaws down here.
Johnny's got these huge pawpaws.
Yeah, it's human nature, truly.
Got to show off your swag.
Mm-hmm.
And by swag, I mean your pawpaws.
Yeah.
His big, juicy pawpaws.
Yeah.
In the sack.
Can we get moving?
No, we can never get moving. All right, so I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about like the modern pawpaw, the one that people are picking or growing, the selections and so on, because now we're getting back into what we just covered a couple months ago. Tree crops time, Matt. You excited?
Tree crops. Oh, yeah.
Tree crops all day.
All day.
Permanent ag movement. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
This is not going to be a surprise to most people listening that have been listening to the show, but the development of the pawpaw as like a crop has been split into kind of like three different periods. The first is the early 20th century. The second is like the mid to late 20th century, like 50 to 85. And then the third is like kind of the last 25 years or so. So this probably sounds a little familiar because we talked about this whole concept of the structure during the permanent agriculture movement, right? Where there's all this work, J. Russell Smith, John Hershey, Russell Lord, all these different folks were working to like try to figure out how to do crops better, specifically with Smith and Hershey, with this idea of like, how do we get the best wild selections and then start a permanent agriculture movement based on perennial crops? So we talked about how in 1916, the American Genetics Association had sponsored J. Russell Smith's honey locust competition. They also, the next year, sponsored a contest for the best pawpaw. The contest was so successful that it discovered, in the words of the people who sponsored it, better fruit than most horticulturalists thought possible.
Dude, this is what I'm talking about. This is the human experience. It's like, check out what I got going on.
Check out these nuts.
Check out my fruit.
Yeah, check out these fruit. Sorry. Wrong episode. I was too excited about tree crops. I thought we were going back in it again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this competition was so successful. A lot of the known pawpaw varieties of the time were found in this one competition. They received fruit from 75 trees, with the winning tree coming from Ironton, Ohio, from a lady named Miss Ketter. And several of these trees were propagated.
That's like Ohio.
Yes, basically. And that's where the Ketter and Fairfield varieties came from originally. As we've talked about, even though that they found these amazing tasting fruits, the fact that the fruit is difficult to ship, is difficult to store, and there's very limited use of it as a food source, because I guess Americans just don't do a really great job of like eating fruit. Like we're not fruit cookers, right? Fruit is always like the sweet thing you either put on toast or you eat it raw.
Mm.
We don't do a whole lot of like duck with blueberry sauce or anything like that. At least not here in the US.
That's a good point. That's just a very good point. We don't cook many fruit.
Yeah, and I think it means that it limits what our fruit, like when they're not very good with like shelf life, it kind of limits what you're going to do with them.
You make pawpaw applesauce. Applesauce.
Okay, I could see it.
That sounds pretty good.
It could be good. Somebody make applesauce and send it to us.
Let us know.
Well, first taste it. Tell us if it's good. If it is good, send it to us.
It's not good. Why bring it up?
Now, I mentioned it's in Ohio where the winning trees came from. This is going to be something that's important later on.
I mean, we kind of brought it up before. It's like the area between Five Nations and the naming in Illinois country.
Yeah, this is true, but we're going to go into a little more detail in a minute. The first record of active variety development was documented in this book from a guy named J.A. Little, and it's called Little's Treatise. It was a little book. It's 20 pages, 20-ish pages.
Beautiful.
Right?
That man knew what he was born for.
He understood a brand. You got to hand it to him.
Mm-hmm.
his first named pawpaw is a tree called Uncle Tom. This was an open pollinated seed from Superior Wild Fruits and part of regularly laid out orchard that he created from select seed. And it's consisted of 35 trees. These 35 trees were on the property of a guy named Judge John V. Hadley in Danville, Indiana. Not far away in Farmingdale, Illinois, Benjamin Buckman also collected 12 named pawpaw varieties. Buckman wasn't just some random dude. He also was responsible for the Farmingdale pear rootstock, which is like still a pretty big staple in like pear rootstocks. And he was a pretty big horticulturalist.
Man, these names are just fantastic.
Right?
Okay, so they're all in like the Great Lakes-ish region, despite that the fruit range went all across the South.
Yeah, and remember I'd mentioned there was that pawpaw split during the last ice age.
You did mention that.
I did mention that, and like the oaks, it's going to matter. Before we get there, though, a guy named George Zimmerman saw all the prospects from that competition, and he decided he was going to basically dedicate the rest of his life to breeding pawpaws. And he did this by creating an orchard in Piketown, Pennsylvania in 1923. He would manage this for 18 years, and it would ultimately have over 60 named and unnamed varieties, and likely included all of the known varieties of the time. Some trees in the collection were controlled crosses between better varieties, but many, if not any of them, were ever named or released. They may have been in the documentation was lost, which is why I'm not saying none, but probably not. Zimmerman died in 1941 unexpectedly, so he never actually saw some of his crosses fully mature. Only three controlled crosses were protected from all those in his orchard, and those are Ketter, Buckman, and Taylor. His widow donated these to the Blandy Experimental Farm in Boyce, Virginia.
Man, we really need to do a better job of making sure this stuff doesn't get lost.
And they wouldn't if we built better communities around our resources. And I think things are getting better, but I do worry that if we forget how easily it was lost, we're going to end up doing it again. Now, the Blandy Experimental Farm continued Zimmerman's work, collecting new genetics and breeding. They worked with John Hershey, who sold unnamed crosses from their breeding work, which are probably across the landscape in people's backyards and no one knows. And a lot of the work that Hershey was doing, as well as the Blandy Experimental Farm, were later incorporated into Ron Peterson's breeding work. Other breeders continued to find new superior varieties and planted them out, such as Ernest J. Downing, who discovered Middletown and Madison, WLW, which were propagated near New Madison, Ohio. Again, Ohio. Homer Jacobs in 1934 planted seeds from an improved fruit, which he named Sweet Alice, which has since been lost. A couple of Zimmermans have been discovered through various genetic markers, but we still don't think we have many of those, and most of the stuff that we had has been since lost from the 40s and 50s.
Okay, so some of Zimmerman's work was lost, but not all of it, and now we have this sort of like big, weird family tree. Just like a pawpaw tree.
Just like a pawpaw tree, a pawpaw cluster, except these ones are genetically not related. But before we get into that like second era, we're going to take a quick break. Hey, we're taking a quick break in the episode to remind you that you can get a whole lot more information from poorproles.com. On our website, we have access to our supplemental reader for the podcast, which provides more depth and context, as well as thorough citations for all of the stuff we talk about in the show. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which updates you about limited releases, such as various nursery stock that we sometimes sell through the Poor Proles website, as well as updates about new merch that we have. You can also support the show through that website, poorproles.com, where you have access to our Patreon and our Substack to get early releases for articles and episodes. Now, if you enjoy the show and are just looking for even more audio content, go check out Tomorrow Today, which just wrapped up season one, or tune into The Gastropocene, which is a project of myself and Dr. Aisha Khan to discuss the way our diets have driven the Anthropocene and what it looks like to use our diets for good. Now, back to the show.
Thank you.
Into the 1950s, much of the interest in the pawpaw was driven by our good friends over at the Northern Nut Growers Association.
Oh, yeah.
That shouldn't be a huge surprise, given that, like, it's a bunch of fucking nerds that care about plants and fruiting plants and calorie-producing plants. And, like, Hershey was a notoriously famous NNGA member, J. Russell Smith, Peterson, Zimmerman. They were all NNGA members. So, like, there's always a lot of overlap between these groups. And like I said, we did lose a lot of Zimmerman's collection when he died. And when the director of the Blandy Experimental Farms nursery decided to retire, a guy named Orland White, a lot of that nursery was also lost, despite being like, huh, he just saved us from losing these three trees. We should keep track of this stuff this time. We learned nothing. And we started research from scratch again over the next 35 years.
Wow. They really saw what happened a decade prior and just did it all over again.
Yeah. Not great. So, the World War II happened. If you don't know about what happened to tree crops during World War II, go check out that episode. If you do, we're going to continue on. So, after World War II, some other folks started getting into the pawpaw scene, as it's called. A guy named W.B. Ward discovered Overlease in Rushville, Indiana, and that tree was found only 70 miles from where J.A. Little's managed orchard was a few decades prior. Overlease is basically the standard for fruit size and flavor today. While some people think that Overlease was wild and just like identified as like this fantastic wild fruit, a few people, including Peterson, disagree, saying that like Indiana was a hotspot for breeding, and it was also in like this very specific area where a lot of breeding work was being done.
But also they had some, you said they had some great wild genetics in that area as well.
Yeah, so they did have tons of wild genetics, and we're going to get to that in a minute, because I think you're starting to see the point I was trying to make about the genetics. But before we get there, just for context, not only was Little like only 70 miles away, but others were really close by. So like Arthur Osborne, who provided Zimmerman with the Osborne variety, was close by, only 15 miles away. And one of the runner-ups in that 1916 contest came from Julietta, only 30 miles away. So we're talking about like this plant that goes across North America, and all of the best selections are within like an 80-mile range, which is just like, is that statistically significant, right? That's a big deal. And again, this is a reminder of the importance of developing long-term plans for these genetics, because this breeding work, which to your point, probably started with wild selections or wild management, happened over dozens of lifetimes. And without a plan to pass on this work, it kind of gets lost to history.
Man, we need like orchards, like monuments.
Or we could use some kind of like almanac to document this stuff.
Now that's interesting. Speak on that for five seasons.
Yeah, I might. Let me think about that. And that's part of why we've been doing these series and the way we've been talking about the fruits and the trees and some of the folks we've interviewed, because we have to do that kind of stuff. Somebody has to do it. It doesn't have to be us, but apparently we're gonna. So that's cool. As the 70s and 80s rolled on, more new varieties were named. Many of the names that are bigger today in the pawpaw space started to become known. Doug Campbell, John Gordon, Corwin Davis, Milo Gibson. For the six people that know all of those names, feel real cool right now.
What's up?
What's up? So in 1981, Neil Peterson, the same guy who made the case about humans and non-humans being responsible for pawpaws moving north, began a large-scale breeding program to develop improved pawpaw varieties at agricultural experimental stations in Queenstown and Keedysville, Maryland. He started with 1,483 accessions, which were open-pollinated seedlings, mostly coming from those collections we had mentioned before, Blandy, Buckman, Hershey, and Zimmerman. By 1994, Peterson had selected 18 numbered selections and 10 named varieties. During this time, in 1990, two more competitions were held for pawpaws, hoping to get some new wild genetics that maybe were missed in the past, and this was done by a guy named Brett Calloway at KSU, and that's Kentucky State University. And while they got 400 entries, most of which were new selections from the wild, again, the winner came from the same region in Salem, Indiana, and that's the variety now known as Wells.
Okay, so another one from west of the Appalachians.
Yeah, there was a second competition that was held as well, organized by a guy named Mark Blossom. No varieties were selected from this, but, you know, A for effort. Now, the collection from the KSU competition led to a pawpaw research program at KSU, where much of the leading pawpaw research is being done today. So cool, we have it, like, institutionalized. Maybe we won't lose it this time.
It's like a D1 pawpaw program.
A D1 pawpaw program. Should be a P1 pawpaw program. Get it? P1? Like pawpaw 1?
Yeah. No, I got it.
Okay. I mean, it should be maybe P2 for pawpaw.
What were you saying about them earlier that you're going to continue now?
Oh, okay. Fine. I see how it is. So today, pawpaws are kind of in this like weird middle stage of domestication. They're like a teenager. They're still kind of like raccoons. They're angsty, but they're also very cute and adorable. So breeders are working to create these like controlled crosses and hybrids of superior selections that can be released to the public, but there still aren't any real commercial orchards that are like bearing fruit at like any meaningful scale. Now our buddy Peterson is kind of the standard bearer for whatever you want to call it, leading the charge on this whole thing.
It's on the cutting edge.
Cutting edge, yeah. He has developed a bunch of testing methods that should be, in his opinion, considered for future research. So he's pointed out that seed size and fruit size seem to be controlled by the same genes. So a real focus on breeding shouldn't just necessarily be about fruit size and quality, but also on breeding fruit that shows like independence of seed size and fruit size, so that you can get bigger fruits or same size fruits with smaller seeds, right? Fortunately, the largest cultivar that we have today only has what we might consider like moderate seed size based on the research, which would suggest that the Susquehanna pawpaw might be a really good starting point for future breeding work.
And I'm guessing the Susquehanna is east of the Appalachians.
While it was planted east and it was named after that region, its actual genetics come from the same region of Indiana and Illinois. Now, the question is, what is going on? And I think I might be onto something, but I haven't seen anyone else talking about it, so take this with, like, a thick tablespoon or two of salt.
Okay, listeners, here we go. This is my favorite part of every episode, the wild speculation part.
We should really call this, like, the Fox News segment, but it's it's like Fox like the animal, right? Think about it.
Spell the same, though.
Right? So, yeah, truly unhinged
welcome
content
to the
coming.
Speculation Nation.
The no-spin zone. So, while we know that during the last glacial period, we had these two populations split, right? We can see these different clusters migrated in different ways. Like, the cluster that was in Mexico really stayed to the north and west of the Appalachians, right? While the cluster from Florida kind of stayed south and then went up the coastline. It doesn't seem like from the genetic evidence that the mountains allowed for a lot of dispersal and crossbreeding. There's very limited genetic overlap of the pawpaw based on this.
That super makes sense based on their habitat, really deep, fertile soils. It's not mountain.
They wouldn't be able to do well going over the mountain, right?
Right.
So, like, considering this within the context of the wild selected varieties, it casually appears, casually being the operative word here, the fruit that genetically is tied to Mexico historically seems to be the ones that are showing the most wild, like, the highest benchmark or baseline for working with it as a wild fruit for improvement, right? What's interesting, too, is that the cluster from Florida has higher genetic diversity. Now, this could be from less selection pressure in the past because people either from the Ice Age or from less human management, or it probably also is a reflection of the fact that we do know like the regions west of the Appalachians, like Mississippi and the, like we had talked about the Adena and the Eastern Agricultural Complex, where people actually were documented domesticating crops, that they would have also been managing the trees as well, the way they were aggressively managing annuals.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to add up. That makes sense to me.
Yeah, and that is based on my totally unscientific and uneducated analysis of it. But it does seem to make sense.
So the people that are those things, get back to us.
And tell me that I'm right. If I'm wrong, say nothing. That's how we know facts, is because we only get told when we're right. Right, Matt?
That's right.
So you think Matt doesn't talk a lot in the show, but he actually talks a ton. And it's just me cutting him out anytime he tells me, well, actually.
Anytime I disagree.
Yeah, every time he gets cut out.
I thought this was a free speech zone, Andy.
It's a no-spin zone. And the spin is away from when I'm right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there's no spin. Got it?
Got it.
All right. So to this point, we've talked about like the history of the pawpaw, the genetics of the pawpaw, the recent history of the pawpaw, why we don't have tons of pawpaws on our shelves. We haven't really talked too much, rather, about why they're not as readily on our shelves. So we talked about the fact that they aren't because they're not shelf stable. But why are they not shelf stable? Now, the reason is that the fruit brown very quickly. And this is because, unlike many fruit, they have a very neutral pH. If you're a neutral pH, you don't have a lot of acidic qualities, right? And that's something we see in like super shelf stable foods. It's kind of like, I don't know, the opposite of pickling, right?
Mm-hmm.
Researchers are trying to figure out a way to fix that, or like, well, how do we get around this? The big thing that most people use is like freezing. Now, when it comes to freezing, the best cultivar for freezing, fortunately, is our good friend, the Susquehanna.
Oh, yeah.
Based on whatever researchers look at when it comes to freezing fruit. Other fruit are better for things like juice production, like the Overlies. Today, most of the frozen and fresh fruit that's sold today is used for like ice cream and beer and like jams, which I support all of those things.
Okay, listeners, please note that if you do have pawpaw beer on hand, that you can mail it to us. Whether or not they stop you at the post office is another story, but you can try, and we will receive it happily.
Yeah, we did have somebody try to mail us black walnut beer, and it did not make it, which was really disappointing. Mm. I was very excited for it.
Bummer.
So shout out to that guy. I wish I could remember his name off the top of my head, but I can't. I might have to cut that in later if I can find it.
You're just going to be like, thanks, Joshua.
Yeah, something like that. It'll be like when they cut it out and they're just like, John Smith. Yeah, it'll be great. Now, another alternative to like that conventional fruit usage is creating pawpaw flour, which like is an interesting concept, right? Researchers that like mess around with this stuff, which seems like a really cool job, they actually mixed in like 10% pawpaw flour into wheat flour, and it didn't meaningfully change the flavor profile of the cookie of like cookies, which is like a pretty cool thing. And it also increased like nutrients, because unsurprisingly, pawpaw fruit is probably a little bit healthier than to you for you than like generic whole wheat flour.
Mm.
Which actually brings me to another important piece of data around pawpaw. Pawpaw as a fruit, one of the things you hear about is that it's like got some nutritional situations going on. So most of the data on pawpaw, like as a fruit that you can eat and like the health, nutritional analysis, is all based in this like 1982 study. The problem with that 1982 study is that it was reported with like the skin and the pulp together, despite the fact you don't eat the skin.
Mm.
And it's been really like widely cited as a study, but few people have actually bothered to look and say like, huh,
I
don't know anyone. Yeah, this data is wrong. It's fundamentally
misinformed science. Oh, no, jeez.
Yeah, we haven't covered any of that.
Well, okay. In fairness, that's probably, that sounds more like a livestock fodder analysis.
It could be. I don't think that was the intent. Or maybe it was the intent, but again, somebody cited it and didn't actually know what they were looking at,
mm-hmm.
which happens a lot.
I only read the abstract, though, so I gotta infer most of it.
Yeah, that could be a problem. So pawpaw, unsurprisingly, is like a fruit. 1/2 cup has been said to have 25% of your daily fiber, 6% potassium, and is basically pretty comparable to like a banana or like a mango.
Fruit has fruit profile. Game-changing statement.
Well, yes, but also no, but also yes.
And no, but yeah.
But also maybe no. So one thing you hear about sometimes with pawpaw is like, is it actually safe to eat? So research has shown that there's these bioactive compounds in the tissue of the fruit that show anti-tumor and anti-cancer properties, antioxidant benefits, suppression of adipocyte proliferation, and anti-obesity activity, among a number of other things. In fact, the acetogenins that are responsible for the inhibition of cancer cells have been noted to be so worthy of further research that there have been several papers like going further into it as like an actual cancer medicine.
Ooh.
Yeah, like kind of a big deal, right? It's also supposedly these same compounds that can cause people to get sick from eating too much pawpaw. And this is based on a guy named Dr. Jerry McLaughlin. While reactions to the fruit happen, there doesn't seem to be any conclusive evidence at this point that points to any long-term risks from eating reasonable amounts of fruit.
Okay, define reasonable amounts.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you, but probably like less than like a pound a day. But to like counterweight this, it's those same cancer-fighting acetogens that a study from the University of Louisville pointed out or identified as toxic substances that, in their words, in quote, inhibit critical biological functions.
Yikes. But I don't know. Within the context of just like eating it, like you might eat an apple, there's not like a ton of risk. Is that evidence for meaningful risk?
No, I don't think so. I think it's kind of like when you get told like, well, if you ate, you know, 90 pounds of apples and the seeds, you would get, was it arsenic poisoning from the seeds?
Yeah.
So whatever that stat is. And it's like, okay, I get your point, but like, it doesn't affect you.
If you turn into the guy from the math problems.
Yeah. If you're the math problem guy, you're going to have a bad time. But there's a lot of evidence of like health benefits. The other concern is regarding a possible link between the fruit and Parkinson's disease, and lots of evidence of health benefits. Obviously, everybody's bodies are different, but all the fears of health risks seem to be a bit overblown and based on limited research, which points to the fact that we do need to do more research.
You heard it here first, nerds. Drop out of med school. We don't need more doctors. Get into pawpaws.
We need you.
That's the real, the good of humankind. It's not in medicine.
And the moneymaker.
Ain't true. Because you got to chase the bag.
You got to chase the bag. And like peer pressure.
Chase the cluster.
Chase the pawpaws. Chase the big pawpaws.
Mm-hmm. Big pawpaw.
Now, one of the reasons I did want to start this series with the pawpaw is climate change.
Oh, brother.
You know, this whole show started with like fear of climate change and yada, yada, yada. I guess we should talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
By 2070... So I will be dead, but Matt, you might be still here, so this is going to be your problem. Models suggest that the optimal pawpaw habitat will expand substantially northward.
Hell yeah.
As we pointed out, it can handle like significantly cooler climates than like people had probably thought. And as we've covered before, between its range and size of fruit and the fact it can be an understory tree, it's hard to see why it wouldn't become more of a focal fruit in our interest of like integrating native crops into a sustainable diet that can like support ecological function.
I mean, that you've summed it up right there pretty well. That is the dream. I guess I have that to look forward to.
Right? More pawpaws?
Yeah, like 15 foot higher sea levels, but like there might be some pawpaws around.
But maybe 15 pound pawpaws.
Yeah. Maybe they'll drink up the seawater. And put it in pawpaws.
With all those deep tap roots, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They'll look back on this episode in 2070 and be like, wow, we were so ignorant before the ascent of the Rat King or something like that.
Yes. This is like the butterfly effect. This pawpaw episode like causes somebody to grow one more pawpaw tree, and that one has some weird genetic anomaly that all future pawpaws are stemmed from. It's like pawpaw Jesus, the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost. That is the Father, that tree. We are the Holy Ghost because we inspired all of them. It all comes together. Feel the flow, Matt.
Andy, I think you need to go back to Sunday school.
So yeah, that is our rundown on the pawpaw. Hopefully people are excited about these fruit. If they're not, If you want to grow them, typically your little baby plants or seedlings, if you get seeds, you got to keep them in shade for the first few years. They need nice deep tap roots, so you got to get them in the ground pretty soon. The seeds take forever to germinate. You're going to think they're dead, and then it's going to be like the middle of June, and they're going to randomly finally sprout. You're going to be like, what the hell? Because they need the soil to be super warm. So if you're into that, go check it out. We typically sell pawpaws here, so we'll probably do a post about that when we get closer to that time of year. So follow us on the socials, the medias, all those good things. Support us on Patreon.
Get your hands on pawpaw.
Get your hands on that pawpaw. If you are annoyed by commercials, you can support us by joining Patreon and getting the episodes early and without commercials. Obviously, you get our commercials. So if you want to hear Norm's nuts, you miss Norm, he'll be there for you. Don't worry.
He's waiting just for you.
Just for you.
Around the Patreon.
And that's basically it. Matt, did I forget anything?
Not a friggin' thing. That was an extensive dive.
That was real aggressive. Friggin'.
Friggin'.
Cool. So next week, we'll be back with our first interview of the season. How's it feel to be back, Matt? Are you excited?
It feels great. And this was a good one to jump off on. I'm looking forward to exciting things, and not the puns, though.
If you could only see his eyes as he said that.
He was so disgusted. Not more of those, though.
The paw puns.
All right, this was good talking to you, Andy. I'll be down in the basement.
Yeah, enjoy your silence.
Yeah.